Hello, Chautauqua. We want to get started. So, welcome back, everybody. My name is Shel Seligson. I'm a member of the Premium Committee. I want to welcome you all to the Upper Jewish Life Center. This center is the Jewish House on the Chautauqua campus. This marks our 10th anniversary. Week 6, we're going to have a big celebration, to which you're all invited. Let me just review the program very quickly because our speaker has some news direct from the Supreme Court this morning. I don't think you'll be happy with it, but she'll tell you about it. On Wednesday afternoon at 3:30, we have a repeat of a movie called It's Gotta Be Me, which is about Sammy Davis Jr. It's a terrific movie. It's about 100 minutes long. You're all invited to that. Thursday, there's a Yiddish language conversation at 12:15. And please put all your trash in the cans. Take it with you, please. Turn off your cell phones, please. We have a book for sale out of the recipes at the Everett House. That's for sale. And also, there are envelopes for hopefully contributions that you will make. We had one of the board members here yesterday who told everybody that the expenses to run this house are over $100,000 a year. We get no money from the institution. We get no money from any other place. So please, take an envelope, put a check in, large or small, mail it in, drop it off. We appreciate it. So there's a Broadway show now called Hello, Dolly. We have a Everett House version. It's called Hello, Dahlia. So take it away, Dahlia.
Yeah, okay. Hi. Well, I thought yesterday that today would be exciting, but holy cow, they did post the cases. So for those of you who have not had your radio on this morning, the Supreme Court handed down two of the last four decisions of the term. There are two more that will be decided tomorrow, and they happen to be the two that we were going to talk about anyway. So it turns out that Chautauqua is in charge of the world. So the two were, for folks who have not been online yet this morning, one in a case out of California that had to do with crisis pregnancy centers and the mandatory requirements of what they post in their centers. By a 5-4 margin, Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion saying that that was compelled speech in violation of the First Amendment and that those postings will not be constitutional. We'll talk about that in a minute. And the other decision that was made was in the travel ban, Trump versus Hawaii. And by a 5-4 margin, John Roberts, writing on behalf of the five conservatives on the court, upholds the travel ban in its entirety and essentially says, writing for the court, it is not for us to pierce the president's motives. It is not appropriate for us to make determinations. When he says this is a national security issue, we take him at his word. Justice can't, so that's the news. There's really, that's what it is. And I've filed two pieces today, and I'm going on Matt out tonight. So I confess not read all of both opinions. They're very long, but let's talk through them, and then I can take questions. In the travel ban litigation, as you probably know, this was originally effectuated in January of 2017. At the time, the president put an all-out ban on travel from 8 countries, all of which were Muslim-majority countries, and stopped refugees from coming in for 120 days. That was the first travel ban last January. That was enjoined immediately by 5 different courts around the country. So that ban never went into effect. There was a second ban that was passed in March of 2017, That one added two countries, Venezuela and North Korea, and said, we're taking out the part of the original travel ban. They removed one country, Iraq, added Venezuela and North Korea, and said it can't be a Muslim ban because we've added these two other countries from which, by the way, we don't have travelers. Venezuela has a few consular travelers. We don't have a lot of vacationers coming from North Korea. So those two countries were added to the ban, and then the president took out language that had been in the first iteration of the executive order that said we're going to give special solicitude to people who are minority religionists from these Muslim countries, which he then said in a speech that night, we're going to protect Christian travelers who are coming from those countries. So that language comes out. That second travel ban, as you will recall, was supposed to go to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court upheld part of it this time last year, struck down part of it, allowed refugees to come into the country if they had what the court called a bona fide relationship with an American. And then the third travel ban, 3.0, is passed in September of 2017. And that one has been further cleansed of what looks like religious animus, and that Hawaii versus Trump is the one that was argued that went to the Supreme Court that was decided today. That was brought by two plaintiffs in Hawaii, a Muslim imam who said that his family couldn't travel to see him, and another Muslim group. And the two issues, we talked about this a little bit yesterday, the two issues before the court were, one, a statutory question under the Immigration and Nationalization Act. The act has conflicting provisions. One is that it gives presidents vast discretion to do things that are in the national security interest, but it also does not allow the president to deny people to come to the country based on nationality. So there was a statutory conflict built into the statute. And then there was the secondary question, we talked about it a little bit yesterday, and that was, is it a violation of the Establishment Clause? I'm going to actually stop being on my toes. Okay, that's better. I realized I could not stand on my tiptoes for an hour. Is it a violation of the Establishment Clause? We talked about that yesterday, that you cannot favor one religion or disfavor another. So the question was, the plaintiff said, if you are overtly disfavoring Muslim travelers, then this must be an Establishment Clause violation. The Ninth Circuit had, on both of these fronts, said it is both statutorily and constitutionally impermissible to have this travel ban. The Fourth Circuit, based in Virginia, had done the same. And this case was argued at the Supreme Court on April 25th. So, in effect, what the president said today is that the statutory problem, he was just they just couldn't get into questions of national security. That their view was if the president did what he says he did, which he tasked his DHS and his Justice Department and the rest of his security apparatus with doing this multi-agency review, and they made a determination that these countries are dangerous and that they have inadequate procedures in these countries to vet who's coming, then we have to defer to that multi-agency review. In other words, this is what the Justice Department argued all along in this case, that we have to afford what's called a presumption of regularity, that the Justice Department and DHS and all the departments did their designated due diligence and that this is a proper presidential act. And then on the question of the harder question, which we were grappling with here, is there some religious animus that underlies this? And what do we do with the fact that the president overtly campaigned on the promise that he was going to have, as you'll recall, the language was a complete and total shutdown on Muslims coming into this country. That promise was still on his website when this case was argued at the Fourth Circuit. what do we do with the fact that when he signed the second version of the travel ban, he said, we all know what this means. What do we do about the fact that his advisor, Rudy Giuliani, said we had to take out the Muslim stuff and do it by territory? So we cleaned it up and we made it about physical location and not about religion. And that Trump himself said on NBC News, we're still doing the Muslim ban, we're going to do it based on country so that it's constitutional. So there have never been a lot of question that these remarks animated what becomes even 3.0 version of the Muslim ban. And John Roberts today, in his majority opinion, just really waves that away. He kind of acknowledges that all those things were said. And then he does a long and interesting discursion about how it's not appropriate for the courts to try to pierce the president's intention or his mindset, that that's not the province of the courts to do. And so we are going to defer, he says, for national security reasons, to the president's determination that we need to do this to keep ourselves safe. He has some language in his opinion where he says, he cites to the comments that have been made and the tweets, but he pretty much pushes them away. Justice Anthony Kennedy has a concurring opinion, and we talked a little bit about Kennedy yesterday as the decider. I will confess to you, and I haven't decided if I'm going to write this piece, but it seemed to me that for the last 2 weeks, watching what was going on at the borders and watching the president take a different posture from his own attorney general, who took a different posture from the head of the Department of Homeland Security, the fact that nobody had a coherent story about why we were taking children from their parents, particularly when their parents were lawful asylum seekers at lawful points of entry. What was going through my head for the last 2 weeks was, Anthony Kennedy can't possibly be watching this happening, watching the president say, this is Congress's fault, only Congress can fix it, and then fixing it with an executive order, having said he can't fix it. I thought to myself, this has to be the bridge too far for Anthony Kennedy while he's signing off on the travel ban. And so I was wrong. It turns out Anthony Kennedy is the fifth vote. And I will tell you, in his concurrence, he has this love song to the possibility that the courts could check unconstitutional actions. So he just wants you to be super clear that if the president ever did something unconstitutional, Anthony Kennedy is watching. But apparently this wasn't it. So that's the 5-4 decision in the travel ban. And needless to say, this had already been, the injunction had been lifted by the Supreme Court in December. So this has already been in effect for the last few months. My friend Becca Heller, who is the head of IRAP, that's the refugee project that brought this litigation, just sent me a note reminding me that this is the anniversary of John F. Kennedy's Ich bin ein Berliner speech, reminding us that nations can't be so protective of their nationhood that walls can separate us. So today is the anniversary of that. So that's that decision. And then let's just run through NIFLA versus Becerra, which is the other one that came down today. This is, again, an amazing conflation of speech and religion claims, very similar to the masterpiece cake shop that we talked about yesterday. This was a 2015 regulation that the state of California passed trying to regulate what are called crisis pregnancy centers, CPCs. Crisis pregnancy centers there are hundreds of them all around the country. They are almost always nonprofits that are affiliated with religious groups, and they have tended to spring up very close to actual abortion and reproductive rights facilities. So these centers tend to pop up. If you Google, pregnant looking for help, they will be the first things you will see. Often, if you Google them, that you will see ads that show an ultrasound technician with a stethoscope, although there is nobody licensed to perform those functions on the facility. And they tend to be also, they really do buy, when abortion clinics close, they buy that property and use that space. In Ohio, there are crisis pregnancy centers that literally set up in trucks next to Planned Parenthood clinics, and then they have escorts come and find women in the parking lot and say, why don't you come to this better center instead of going into Planned Parenthood? And they expressly, this is not a matter of opinion, it's in Justice Thomas's decision today, they expressly have a political viewpoint that they want to discourage abortion. And so they hold themselves out to be facilities where women can go if they are pregnant and want to know all of their choices, but they will expressly not tell you that abortion is an option, and they will expressly not tell you in California under Medi-Cal that it is paid for by the state. So the state of California in 2015 passed something called the Reproductive Fact Act, and what they essentially said is that there are going to be two requirements for all crisis pregnancy centers. One is that the ones that are licensed have to put up, post somewhere on the facility, the information, the California says truthful information, that abortions and other reproductive services are available in California. They are available at low cost. Here is the phone number for the agency that can hook you up with those services. And the unlicensed centers have to post something that says, we actually don't have a license to provide medical service. We really give out diapers and we give, you know, good information about adoption, but we are not a licensed medical facility. Those were the two provisions. And the groups that sued, and this is the same group, by the way, somebody asked about the cake baker, about the masterpiece litigation, the same group, the Alliance Defending Freedom, which spearheaded Jack Phillips' claims in the masterpiece cake shop, also brought this litigation on behalf of the crisis pregnancy centers in California. And their claims were exactly the ones we discussed yesterday. They made both religious liberty claims, and they made free speech claims. They said, you are forcing us to do something, to post information that violates our religious freedom under the First Amendment. And secondarily, they said, you are forcing us, very much like the cake baker, to, you're commandeering us to speak in ways that offend our religious conscience. So it really, it's a twin to masterpiece. Very much like Masterpiece, by the time it gets briefed and argued at the Supreme Court, it's a speech claim. The religious liberty claims fall out of this case as well. And the court hears it as a compelled speech claim. And today the Supreme Court decides, again 5-4, Clarence Thomas writing for the five, that this is compelled speech, that it is directly targeting these minority clinics for something that is their, he says it, religious viewpoint, and therefore it is subject to what's called strict scrutiny. Lawyers in the room know that strict scrutiny is the highest level of constitutional scrutiny. If the courts look at something through the lens of strict scrutiny, it almost never survives. I think the way I tell this to people on the podcast is, the difference between strict scrutiny and intermediate scrutiny, which are the two ways the court can assess these challenges, strict scrutiny is like, go ask your father. Intermediate scrutiny is, go ask your mother. So maybe the way to do it here is, like, intermediate scrutiny is, go ask your grandparents. You're going to get a yes. Strict scrutiny means you're going to get a no. And I apologize, that's a ridiculously heteronormative thing I just did, but okay. Strict scrutiny, you're going to get a no, and sure enough, the court decides no. This case gets kicked back to California to look at it again because it appears to be targeting religious speakers and forcing them to make statements that are anathema to their religious views. So this is really, I think, maps perfectly onto what we talked about yesterday with Masterpiece, in that it's these are religious claims that come up as speech claims, and then they get decided as religious speech claims or speech about religion. And Justice Thomas is very, very clear about the point in his view that these are religious entities who are being singled out. Justice Kennedy writes a concurring opinion in this case as well, and it is really, I think, if you don't see it covered today, you should read it yourselves, because it is a staggering two paragraphs, where he essentially says, on behalf of himself and three other justices who concur with him, that the very nature of tyranny that the framers were afraid of is a state singling out certain speakers and telling them that they had to do something. So he's calling that authoritarianism and tyranny, what the state of California is doing. And this is the same Justice Kennedy who, in the travel ban case, which comes down 10 minutes later, says, that's that case. And I think that the other thing that I just want to say about the travel ban case is, in both cases, we have the four usual dissenters, Ginsburg, Breyer, Kagan, and Sotomayor. In the CPC case, in Niflo versus Becerra, the Crisis Pregnancy Center case, Justice Breyer writes an incredibly angry dissent where he makes the point, and I think this is important, that if you are going to say that medical professionals cannot be commandeered to say things that are not true, all of the states, and I think there's 18 of them currently, that have scripts where physicians, before they can provide an abortion, have to read from these scripts that say abortion is linked to higher instances of breast cancer and suicide and suicidal ideation. If you have to read that script in those states, then it cannot be possible that those scripts survive this decision. Because if doctors can't be told to give you information that is not, in their view, medically sound, then doctors cannot be told to give you information that is not medically sound in the states where there are warnings. And he uses the language, he used this at oral argument, what is sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. So I think he is at least holding out the possibility that in jurisdictions that commandeer doctors to say things they don't believe to be true, those laws may fall. I'm not incredibly sure, based on Clarence Thomas's analysis in this case, that that follows. But that will be the next line of cases to watch. Again, I think this is such a freighted problem because these are religious dissenters. Yeah. They don't want to do something that violates their religion. And the court is so protective of that speech in a way that factual medical information violates that. That's just not the same as a clinician in Mississippi who says, I cannot read a script that says there's a correlation between abortion and breast cancer. So Justice Kennedy, Justice Breyer, I think, is trying to say, let's go now and strike down all of those laws in those jurisdictions. I don't know when I read Justice Thomas that that's going to follow. The only other thing I want to say about the travel ban cases is that, again, there are four dissenters, but there's two very, very different dissents. Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan, who are quickly becoming, I think, the court's moderate center, who are not willing to go as far as Kagan and Sotomayor time after time, dissent in the travel ban case with a dissent that says, of course, we think there is Muslim animus here, but B, one of the ways that the Solicitor General tried to defend the Muslim ban was by saying that there is a waiver process and that consular officials can grant waivers to anybody who is in dire need of a visa or in dire need of entry, that they can be waived in under all these three humanitarian grounds. And there was some evidence that came up after oral argument that actually consular officials no longer have the authority to grant waivers. There's a lawsuit currently going on now in Washington, D.C., where two consular officials have signed affidavits saying, we don't have any authority to grant people from these banned countries a waiver. That is decided in Washington at DHS. So Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan take judicial notice of the fact that they're calling, Justice Breyer is calling the waiver thing that's supposed to save the travel ban, he's actually using the word window dressing to describe it. He says there's not actually a way to save people who are coming here and really need to be waived in. The other dissent, and again, I think it's the one that will get news coverage tonight, is the one that is Justice Sotomayor writing with Justice Ginsburg. And she really is willing to do the thing that no one else is willing to do. She says, I'm going to go boom, 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 and just highlight every single anti-Muslim thing that has been said at every stage of this, not merely the anti-Muslim rhetoric from the campaign, but the things that were said after throughout this litigation. And then she basically concludes, no reasonable observer could say this wasn't rooted in Muslim animus. But there are only two votes for that proposition. And I think that one of the things that's going to be the next day story is why this split between Justices Kagan and Breyer, who are much more temperate, and Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg, who are much more willing to say, you know, if it quacks like a duck, it might actually be a Muslim ban. So I think that, you know, for purposes of our conversation, and I will leave time for questions, but when we started this journey yesterday, before knowing that these two cases would come down, I tried to make the point, and I think I still make it, that the blurriness between these religion claims and these speech claims is proving to be time and time again confounding the doctrine, because the doctrine in both these cases clearly is about religion, and yet they keep being analyzed as special class of speech cases because these are religious speakers. And I think when I said to you yesterday, we have to have a more robust way to analyze religious claims, because this doesn't work, if they are all going to be weaponized as speech claims, and then we are going to decide which religious speakers we want to protect, then we are really, I think, going down a dangerous road. And I want to be clear about two other things that I think are really problematic as we think about the religion cases going forward. When the Hobby Lobby case came to the Supreme Court properly said, as they must, in these religion cases, it is not for us to make determinations about what is a real religion or whether believers really believe what they claim or whether these views that they hold are authentic religious beliefs. The court has long taken the position that we take religious believers at their word. So, for instance, you remember yesterday we talked about the little sisters, the nuns, who felt that even checking a box that said, I will be triggering an abortion by giving contraception, by checking a box and sending it to the Department to DHS and saying, I want to opt out of giving contraceptive services to our non-Catholic employees, that mere act, when the government then says, okay, we will give the contraception to your employees, you are out of it, that was supposed to be a circuit breaker that the Obama administration compromised and said, you're right, you should not have to do anything that violates your religious beliefs. So as a circuit breaker, you let us know and we'll violate our religious beliefs because we're fine sending these women contraception. That was what the Little Sisters were challenging. The act of simply saying on a piece of paper, I cannot, under my moral view of the world, provide contraception. So remember, we talked about that chain of causation yesterday, that if the mere act of saying, I am opting out, or when we talked about the Jane Roe cases in Texas yesterday, the mere act of the Office of Refugee Resettlement saying, we are going to open the doors to this shelter so this 14-year-old or 16-year-old girl can get an abortion to which she has been lawfully deemed to be eligible, then we are way down the road of what kind of speech is triggering a sin. And so it's not just a conversation about, you know, a cake baker and is this art. We're talking about links, causal links in a chain that anybody can assert. Anybody can say, well, then it violates my religious liberty to do any number of things. And the court in Hobby Lobby said, we have to not probe that. We have to assume, again, for constitutional purposes, that any assertion of religious moral dissent is authentic. And it doesn't mean, I literally think this is the most intractable problem we have going forward. It is certainly not proper for the courts to say, oh, you silly nuns of the Little Sisters, you know, you can't think that checking a box is triggering abortion. That is doctrinally true for them. But what it did mean, at least in Hobby Lobby, is that some of the companies that were claiming that they wanted to opt out of the contraception mandate in Obamacare, Eden Foods later said, we didn't mean it. We're just cheap. We just didn't want to give our workers contraceptive devices. So for the courts to be deliberately having to blinker themselves to those claimants, I think is unbelievably problematic, because taken at its word, anybody who says anything violates their religious liberty has to be afforded the presumption that that is truthful. And I think that is the road we are now going to go down. And I think that it is incredibly difficult to find how the court is going to pick its way through, on the one hand, not getting into the business of, are you a real religion, or are you not a real religion? Does your religion really believe that? It was certainly the case that the American Medical Association, for purposes of the Hobby Lobby litigation, said some of these devices that the groups are objecting to are, in fact, abortifacients. They do arguably trigger abortion. Some of them absolutely do not, under any scientific definition of what triggers an abortion. Some of them are just not that. The court would not take that into account. The court started from the presumption that if these groups label these four devices as abortion-causing devices, we take them at their word. And by the way, Obama's Solicitor General started from that posture. This is not a binary thing. This is assumed on both sides. So I'm not sure how we get out of it. I will tell you, we very quickly, in the Town of Greece case that we talked about yesterday, with the prayers before council meetings, we quickly had, you know, the Wiccans and the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster and the Church of the, I can't remember what they are, the Satan-worshipping church, all saying, you have to afford us the same solicitude you afford other religionists. And that is going to be just a massive problem if the court is going to really take that seriously. They do now in Town of Greece, I'm told, let the Wiccans solemnize prayer and the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Because what are you going to do? You cannot be in a position to say which religion is real and with which is authentic. So I'm going to close before I take questions. I think I just want to close, and I confess I have not read through all of both opinions because in the fashion of great journalists, I had to do radio interviews before. But I will tell you this. I think that there is undergirding both of the decisions that came down today something very profound going on about truth. And what I think we are seeing happening is a disaggregation of justice and law from truth. And so in the Crisis Pregnancy Center's case, the statements that those clinics were intended to post were truthful. There's no dispute that the statement that Medi-Cal will cover this, here is the phone number, there is no person on the premises licensed to do an ultrasound. Those are all factual statements. But Clarence Thomas looks at them and says, no, they are morally freighted statements. They are statements that are in anathema to these groups that have these clinics. And he manages to distinguish between the truth that other professions have. Most of you probably have some kind of, you know, disclosure and disclaimer rules that attach to your professions. And he says, this is different. This is different. Because it cuts against moral and religious beliefs. And I think that's going to be the important thing when we analyze that case to understand what it means. And Justice Breyer is really clear in his dissent that there's no profession that isn't, in fact, in some ways involved in speaking words. And that if you're going to say, you know, all of those professions get to make determinations about what is moral and immoral to them for a religious reason, we're not going to be able to regulate any professional speech. And I just want you to look at that next to the travel ban, which is also about true speech. Whatever else John Roberts does in his majority opinion, he certainly acknowledges that Donald Trump tweeted these things, that Donald Trump said these things, that in interview after interview, members of the administration failed to disavow these things. These things were held out to be truthful speech. And the fact that, again, the court is willing to uncouple that notion of truthful speech from its First Amendment analysis is just so incredibly destabilizing. I say this to you, you know, as a lawyer and a journalist who thinks about the connection between truth and language, that's my job. When the court more or less says in a pair of cases, we're going to get out of the truth business because it inflects on religion, I think that we have to stop and really think about the role of the courts in this conversation. So I don't have, I hope it's been clear to you from the last two sessions, I don't have good answers for any of these. I really want to end where I began, which is that I fundamentally agree with the framers that the core protection of the First Amendment is religious faith and religious dissent, and that you cannot get to those next layers of what it is to be free, including speech, including press, including assembly, if you are afraid to express yourself religiously or afraid the state is going to favor or disfavor your religion. So if you stipulate that that is true, and I do, how we pick our way out of this present moment is really, like, deeply, grievously troubling to me. And I want to end by saying, holy cow, I did not think we'd be doing these cases today. But in some ways, there's probably no place I'd rather be than at Chautauqua, where we still have, I think, such a capacious view of faith and truth that we could at least give the benefit of the doubt that we could work through this together. So thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
very vexing question. I have the first question, and that is, we have a system of checks and balances. We have the United States Supreme Court that is supposed to interpret the Constitution. We have 9 unelected people who serve the way. And if those people don't serve the nation, and all the president has to say is national security and he can do with anything else, where's the protection for the country? How is the court doing its job or not doing its job?
I think that we talked, this was your question yesterday, and we talked about it yesterday. I think the court is very afraid to enter into this moment, into this conversation. I think that the court has all sorts of institutional prerogatives around minimalism and humility and deference to the other branches that allow it, if it chooses, to not wade in to say we're just deferring. Now, one spectacular irony I will tell you of today's case, and I don't know if we talked about this yesterday, but Neil Katyal, who argued the travel ban, he was the acting Solicitor General for Obama, he argued the travel ban case on behalf of Hawaii. And what he said at his oral arguments, both in the Fourth and the Ninth Circuits and then at the Supreme Court, is that Korematsu, the Japanese detention cases that were widely regarded by every single living justice as the low watermark of excessive deference to the executive in wartime, so discredited that, you know, the Solicitor General's office has apologized for it. They have officially enacted statements that say, by the way, the government lied about the detention and there were massive lies and frauds perpetrated on the court in order to sign off on the detention. But Neil Katyal's point was, Korematsu was never overturned. It's still good law. And that has been underlying this case, this theme of course, nobody's ever going to cite Korematsu and say, hey, you know, we should put people in pens, except it's still good law. John Roberts today, in his opinion, says, oh, by the way, Korematsu, we're done with that. So the one happy news today is that we overruled Korematsu today. So we can't actually do mass Japanese detentions if they bomb, you know, Pearl Harbor anymore. So that's good. But, I mean, I think it's a totally fatuous argument, answer to your serious question, which is the court is supposed to be a third co-equal check. And here is where I would say that I am quite certain that if Merrick Garland had been seated, this would have been a 5-4 decision going the other way. So I think that, again, I'm giving you a political answer to a question that is a judicial doctrinal question, but I think this is a court that made a decision. Again, Anthony Kennedy is careful in his concurrence to put a pin in the idea that I don't want to be making claims that the president can never violate the Constitution. And he has an amazing, the last line is, anxious countries around the world should be reassured. I mean, it literally is like, don't freak out, Angela Merkel, I'm here. But he's just not doing it. So I think that, you know, my short and cynical answer is, this is the court truly believing that it is inappropriate for the Supreme Court to make this decision. And as a normative matter, I agree with you. It's shocking. But I think as a descriptive matter, we have seen time and time again, the courts in, again, the Japanese detainment cases saying the president knows what's best and it's not our purview, and that's what happened today.
So if you don't think it's important who's on the Supreme Court, think again. So we're going to take questions out. Please ask a concise question and we'll try to get a concise answer.
This is a precise question. The President of the United States put North Korea on the list as a military security, but he also told me to go to sleep peacefully because they are no longer a nuclear threat to me. Yeah. Did he remove North Korea from that list?
I don't think so. I think North Korea is still on the list.
Well, that's a definition of a security.
That's a good point. I think he would say that he masterfully saved relations with North Korea and now can remove it from the list. But I also want to be clear, North Korea, I don't think there are a lot of people who believe that when North Korea and Venezuela were added, that was for national security reasons, because people don't come. So it
but
was,
that's the
yeah.
Reason.
No, I mean, I think you're completely right. And, you know, Iraq was taken off the list, and it goes without saying, but I'll say it anyway, that all of the 9/11 attackers came from countries that were not on that list. Saudi Arabia was not on that list. Certainly, I think it is fair to say that that list, even the original version of the list, each of those countries are 90-some percent Muslim. I will tell you, just interestingly, one of the things John Roberts says in his opinion today is, and it echoes what Sam Alito said at the arguments, is, oh, come on, if this is a Muslim ban, it's a really bad Muslim ban because there's so many other Muslim countries. And it's just such a strange argument. Like, even though all the countries on the list, except the two countries we added in later that don't send us anybody, even though they are all 90% Muslim countries, because there are other Muslim countries not on the list, it can't be a Muslim ban. And that is actually quite persuasive to the majority today, that, you know, people can come from other Muslim countries, so it can't really be a Muslim ban. And I think Neil Katyal's argument, at oral argument, when he was faced with that question, he said, if I have 20 employees and I only fire 7 of the 9 African Americans, I'm still really racist, but I think that that argument held no water today with the chief.
Another issue.
Yes.
You have had a lot of experience in your 20-plus years doing research on the Supreme Court. Have you seen in your research and your reporting any difference between our Supreme Court judges of men and women?
So this was actually my first time I ever spoke at Chautauqua. I talked about this, and it really is unbelievably interesting, the data about the difference between female and male justices on the Supreme Court. I guess I should point out that all three of the women justices were in both dissents today. But I do think that we were wrong initially when Sandra Day O'Connor was the only woman at the Supreme Court. There was a lot of scholarship that tried to posit that she had this different moral view of the world, that it was this very feminine, it was rooted in Carol Gilligan, if you remember her scholarship, that women have this ethos of caring and other-centered, and that men are, I guess, monsters who just eat everything. And what we learned after Ginsburg joined the court was that all of the scholarship that tried to say that women are other-centered or compassionate or relationship is in fact not true, because all the data showed that whenever you could say that about Ginsburg, you couldn't say it about O'Connor. Whenever you said it about O'Connor, you couldn't say it about Ginsburg. So that I think, fell apart very quickly. What the scholarship has since showed, and I think it's really interesting, is that while in all their years serving together at the court, Ginsburg and O'Connor, one appointed by Reagan, one appointed by Clinton, they actually only agreed about 50% of the time on all the cases that they heard together. But on any case that had to do with gender, they agreed over 90% of the time. And so I think that there is an experiential story there, not about women having different moral reasoning, but that women have a very, very different way of assessing claims about women. And just the coda to that story that is kind of interesting is that they've now started to do really interesting longitudinal studies of, they can't do it at the Supreme Court, we only have 3 justices, but when they do appellate judges who sit in panels of 3 in the federal appeals courts, and they're starting to do really interesting data on what happens when you have a woman on a panel rather than 3 men. And overwhelmingly, again, they do it, it doesn't happen across the boards on all issues, but on questions around gender and gender discrimination and gender pay, if you have 1 woman on a panel of 3, the men are vastly more likely to conform their views to the views of the woman. So the joke I always make is if there's such thing as sort of uniquely female legal or moral reasoning, it's contagious because men seem to do it. And I think it's actually very, very, very of a piece with what we saw when Thurgood Marshall came onto the Supreme Court, which is that it isn't that he necessarily had this unitary view of justice, but he would, in every conference when there was a story to be told about growing up in the Jim Crow South and what it was like to actually be beat up outside courthouses when he was arguing for the NAACP, he would tell stories. And afterwards, Justice Kennedy has written beautifully about this, and Justice O'Connor, the justices would realize, we don't know what we don't know. And having one person in the room say, this is actually how it plays out in the gender or race context, can very much influence the other justices. And my favorite story, I know this is a long answer, but it's my very favorite Supreme Court story, is that when Chief Justice Rehnquist, not a liberal squish by any definition, writes toward the very end of his career about in a case, a really interesting case about the Family and Medical Leave Act. And what he writes is this bolstering, women have a really hard time, they're juggling, they've got kids at home, they've got a sick parent, and it's really hard, and we should really fully understand what the Family Medical Leave Act is. And everybody is reading this going, you know, what happened to William Rehnquist, the guy we all knew? And it turned out that while he was drafting his opinion in this case, his daughter, newly divorced, single mom, has kids. She's literally dropping them in his chambers and saying, I'm out, I'm going to work. And he's got kids running around, and he suddenly realizes, oh my God, it must be really hard to be a single mom taking care of two little kids. And so then he writes this really soaring love song to the Family Medical Leave Act. And I tell the story only because Justice Ginsburg, and she tells it much better than I do, says that when her husband, Marty, read the draft opinion, the Rehnquist opinion in the Family Medical Leave Act case, he literally hollered down the hallway of their apartment, Ruthie, did you write this for him? Like that she had ghost-written this opinion. And she tells the story, and I think she deeply believes that the work of the court is to make visible to people whose lives are different than you what life, we talked about this yesterday, right? This is empathy, and this is solicitude for somebody whose life you don't recognize. And so I think that the difference that the women have made at the court, beyond the sort of, you know, politics and the polemics of it, are just making women's lives visible. And the best, this is becoming a really long answer, I'm sorry, but the best evidence I have of that is that if you go back and you read the transcript in Griswold, which was the decision, the Connecticut decision, affording for the first time a constitutional right to contraception, 9 male justices, no one could utter the name of any device out loud. They were so embarrassed. And one of the advocates got up to try to be clear, because it was very unclear what devices we were talking about. And the Chief Justice was like, it's okay. You don't have to say it. Like, this is so unspeakably awkward that he shut him down. And no names of devices appear in the transcript. And then it's this, like, who's on first comedy, because nobody knows what we're talking about. When Whole Women's Health was argued, which was the big Texas abortion case from a few terms ago, it was so amazing to see the women justices just say IUD and abortion and ovary, and like the walls didn't fall down. Like it's still, you know, the building held. And so I think for me, it is a reason to have diversity at the court. Isn't because all, you know, Latina women think the same way, but that lives as experienced so affect every part of doing justice. And I think if we don't acknowledge that there are differences in how our lives are experienced, then we get the kinds of, I think, very blinkered decisions we got today. Okay, that was a long answer, I'm sorry.
This will hopefully be a quick answer.
Good.
But Justice Thomas's opinion held that even the statement that there are no licensed staff present he is unconstitutional. Is that my understanding?
Okay. Yep. And I don't want to say unconstitutional. He said it's likely unconstitutional. He kicked it back.
Yesterday, John Irving expressed some concern about a drift towards fascism in our country. And given the current situation, Congress in the same political party as the president, and we always look to the judiciary to prevent that kind of slipping along. Are you worried about whether this Supreme Court is going to stand up and protect us?
So this was, in fact, the first case where I believe Trumpism, quad Trumpism, was on the docket. I think that we've had a lot of cases in the last two terms that raised questions about Trump-like policies and Trump-like worldviews. We certainly, you know, have seen, I mean, the big devastation of the voting rights cases, all three of them, devastating. So those are all Trump values. And by the way, this session's Justice Department has flipped sides in more cases than we've ever seen. So it is typically the case that if the Solicitor General's office has a certain posture, as they did in the gerrymandering case, the vote purge case, they don't flip easily because it's unseemly for exactly the reasons you're describing. There's a notion that the rule of law demands that even if the Justice Department changes, that they continue to defend the Obama policies because of appearances. They have flipped in case after case after case, and that, I think, tells you a lot about what the Justice Department is kind of doing right now. But as to the question of, you know, what are the courts going to do, and I think it sort of dovetails with your question about this slippage of the rule of law, I think today is a really sobering day for that. Because what the court did today was not just an assessment of the president's statutory authority under the Immigration and Nationality Act. It was a direct reckoning with Trump and Trumpism, with statements he's made. I think I just filed a piece that said, if it is actually true that he has told 3,600 whatever falsehoods, an opinion rooted in the idea that we have to believe he's telling the truth is truly exceptional. And so I think that this today, in a sense, is the most worrisome thing, because I think that, and I think I said this yesterday, John Roberts is well aware every time Trump tweeted, that's not a real judge, that's a bad judge, that's a fake judge, that's a Mexican judge, every one of those attacks, believe me, John Roberts knows that he is undermining the judiciary. And when Donald Trump tweeted yesterday and the day before that people at the borders should have zero judicial process, John Roberts clocked all of that. So these are attacks directly on an institution that does not have the power to protect itself. And for John Roberts to say, I think he's all right, that is profound. That is profound. And so here's where I will say, I said this to someone yesterday, I think the federal appeals courts have done an extraordinary job of holding back the worst impulses. And if you go through the roster of upholding DACA when they tried to eviscerate it, upholding funding for sanctuary cities when they tried to eviscerate it, striking down the trans in the military ban, I mean, the ACLU itself is just running around and filing suits, and they are overwhelmingly winning in the trial courts and in the federal appeals courts. We talked about this yesterday. Those federal appeals courts are changing unbelievably quickly. But I think that the federal appeals courts, on balance, and this transcends politics and ideology in so many ways. I mean, it's extraordinary how many Bush and Reagan judges have sided against some of the really, really terrifying incursions on the rule of law. But I think that the Supreme Court is where the buck stops. And today, that was where the buck stopped. And I think that to believe for a moment that this is the end of it is a mistake, because this emboldens this administration to say, we have but 5 votes for whatever we're doing down there at the border.
Yes.
So that actually leads into my question that I asked you yesterday that you asked me to bring today, which is, we have a dysfunctional executive branch. We have a beyond dysfunctional legislative branch. You mentioned yesterday the court was stuffing its head down, afraid to make difficult decisions and punting them because they were afraid of retribution from the executive branch. Now today, we're seeing something even worse, that instead of ducking and punting the decisions, they're actually pandering to the executive branch and coming up with irrationally nonsensical decisions in order to pander to them. So I'm asking you to take it one step further. What does this say about the future of our American government, and what does this say about the future of our democracy?
I can't lie. This is a scary time, and I think that you can look back at Dred Scott, and you can look back at shocking, terrible case after shocking, terrible case, including Korematsu, and you have to. I think we have a myth that the courts are foundationally and purposely democratic and progressive institutions. Courts are overwhelmingly small-c conservative institutions. David Cole, the head of litigation at the ACLU, last week told me on a panel, nobody goes to law school because they want to burn stuff down. We are, by design, the most mincing, careful, deliberative creatures around in the law, with a handful of exceptions. And with the exception of the Warren Court, we have seen the courts largely reify and rubber stamp horrible things. So I think that we have this fantasy that the courts exist to protect minorities and freedom and democracy, and history has revealed time and again that that isn't true. Now, 30 years later, we'll say, oh, Korematsu, that was shocking. Dred Scott, that was terrible. But we, in the moment, the courts believe that they are not well situated to do the thing they had to do today, which is make a determination about national security. And by the way, they're not well situated to do that. And so if the accusation is that courts are really conservative, then they are. And as I said when I was asked this before, Merrick Garland, I firmly believe, would not have decided this case this way. So for all the people who didn't vote or who didn't think that the court was an issue, that's your answer. The courts matter. And we have one justice who's 85, one justice who is 81, and one justice who's 89. And there could very, very well be a retirement tomorrow. In fact, I would say, based on Anthony Kennedy's almost complete abdication in the two cases that my reporting said he stayed on to do gerrymandering. That's why he didn't leave last June. And we learned this week gerrymandering didn't get done. And then there was some reason to believe he stayed on to do the travel ban case. And that got done. So I don't think Anthony Kennedy has a lot to say going forward. And I think we may have a vacancy this summer. Can we get one
this
more?
One more, and we got one over there. We're done.
Relative to religious language and behavior that comes out of that, and the court's seeming deference to religious freedom. On my AOL news feed last week, I saw a guy who had Christian conservative, who basically said that all homosexuals should be stoned to death. And I wondered if there would be a case where, if his church decided to carry that out with any gay people in their church, whether the courts would stand in support of them because of their religious freedom.
You went to the dark place. I think we still have laws on the books that preclude murder. I think that under your question is a very serious question about religious liberty and the boundaries of it. And, it is certainly the case, and in the wake of Hobby Lobby and other religious freedom claims that give real force to RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, it will not surprise me to see employers saying, my religious beliefs preclude me from hiring women. My religious beliefs preclude me from hiring people who are not married, women who are not married. So those cases are all in the pipeline. And I think as we suggested earlier, the court is really going to find a hard time if they say that religious liberty claims give you an end run around public accommodations laws. We are going to have a very hard time not immediately having people saying, fine, then, you know, hiring minorities also offends my religious liberty. So I think the reason that the Masterpiece Shop came out the way it did is because the court knows that's a problem, not the stoning of people. I don't think we're there. But certainly I think different kinds of discrimination, meaningful discrimination, and I think that is the future. That is the foreseeable future.
Last question.
Your logic is very persuasive of why these were probably wrong decisions. But you need to look what John Roberts did in the Obama Medicare case. He basically didn't probably vote the way he wanted to, but he decided to go with what Congress wanted. Isn't it really, are we overanalyzing this? Isn't this, and I think you said this a minute ago, it's really that this Roberts and the conservatives basically saying, no matter how bad we might disagree with this decision, it's a presidential prerogative. That's the heart of it. Not the logic of why it's insane.
I think that is the heart of it. And I think I said yesterday that I believe that John Roberts, more than anyone else on the court, is an institutionalist first, before he is, you know, a conservative. And we've seen him defect not just on two of the Obamacare cases, but in a whole bunch of cases this last year that have surprised me on race and sentencing and race. So he, I think, is much more apt. And I would say, statistically speaking, if you look at John Roberts' last term, he agreed with Stephen Breyer in more cases than he agreed with Sam Alito. So I don't think there's any question that Breyer and Kennedy have staked out a sort of center right at the court, which I think increasingly is matched by Kagan and Breyer on the left of the court. In other words, I think we do have a center. This case, even if you strip out all the religious animus stuff and you bracket it the way he did, and if you only look at the national security claims, it is a perfectly plausible reading of the INA to say he simply has this authority under the statute. We assume that the words they use, presumption of regularity, this is a normal president functioning normally and the branches are functioning normally. It is a perfectly plausible reading. My only point is, when you have a president who literally cannot even articulate what this executive order at the border has done, can't even say the words, it's deterrence, that's what my attorney general says, because it'll be struck down in the San Diego litigation pending. I think the presumption of normality and regularity that he wants to impose on this is very scary. But I do take your point, and maybe we'll conclude on this because I really do have to go be on the radio, but I do take your point that the court institutionally, faced with two other institutions that are broken, has two choices. One is to say, we're freaking out, this is crazy, there are no grown-ups here, or, you know, to say, we are going to try to be the adults in the room and proceed normally. And for the year and a half that there were eight justices on the court, that's what they did. And a lot of people said, why don't they give speeches? Why don't they say this is improper? Nobody's ever held a seat open for a year and a half. The court protects the court. It is so vulnerable. And across ideological lines, Justice Kennedy, Justice Breyer, Justice Sotomayor, the Chief Justice, give the same speech. The only currency we have is public confidence. And the court made a decision today. I don't disagree that public confidence requires that we treat this president like he's regular and we treat this order like a statutory problem. I don't disagree.
Thank you, Diane.